This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Other vulnerable people include 1.7 million, the United Nations says, are displaced by drought, and those displaced by conflict in the border areas of the Oromia and Somali regions.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting on urgent humanitarian needs in Ethiopia. Details coming up also. A new report says 124 million people in 51 countries last year faced acute hunger. South Sudan, Somalia, Yemen, and northeastern Nigeria were the hardest hit areas. And Somalia officials say a car bomb has killed at least 14 people on the busiest street in the capital, Mogadishu. We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. A top story, Ethiopia is appealing for $1.6 billion to provide emergency and long-term aid for 7.88 million people affected by drought, floods, and conflict. Lisa Schlein reports from the United Nations in Geneva, where UN officials presented their humanitarian and disaster resilience plan.
Ethiopia is emerging from three consecutive years of drought in a perilous state. Among those hardest hit are some 2.4 million pastoralists who have lost 80% of their livestock. UN resident and humanitarian coordinator in Ethiopia, Ahuna Eziakonwa-Enochi, tells VOA herders depend upon the meat and milk from their animals to feed their families.
So we're estimating in this year that... We will see about 3.5 million children who suffer from moderate acute malnutrition and just over 300,000 who have to face severe acute malnutrition.
Eziakonwa-Enochi warns children who are severely acutely malnourished are at risk of dying if they do not urgently receive special nutritional feeding.
Time is of the essence. Unless we're able to catch them early, we end up having more kids crossing into that red zone of severe acute malnutrition. That's what we're absolutely determined to avoid this year. And that's why we're asking for these resources now, because it's totally preventable.
Other vulnerable people include 1.7 million, the United Nations says, are displaced by drought, and those displaced by conflict in the border areas of the Oromia and Somali regions. They will need to be relocated to areas where there is water so they can restock their animals or pursue other livelihood opportunities. In parallel with the emergency needs, Eziakonwa-Enochi says, the Ethiopian plan aims to build resilience so the nation can better deal with disasters before they strike. For example, she says the government and humanitarian partners are considering digging boreholes in the lowlands. This would make water available for people and their animals when rain is scarce and drought appears on the horizon. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Somali officials say a car bomb has killed at least 14 people in the busiest street in the capital, Mogadishu. The blast occurred outside the Weleye Hotel, which is frequented by politicians and other members of Mogadishu's elite. There was no immediate claim of responsibility, but the Islamist militant group Al-Shabaab has carried out several attacks on the same road in the past. A new report says 124 million people in 51 countries last year faced acute hunger, up from 100 million in 2016. South Sudan, Somalia, Yemen, and northeastern Nigeria were the hardest hit areas. The United Nations and the European Union said today in their annual global report on food crisis that those areas continue to need urgent humanitarian aid. The report says the prospect of acute hunger is rising this year in the Central African Republic, the Democratic Republic of Congo, the Lake Chad region, Libya, and the Central Sahel. The report says the rise in hunger comes primarily from new or intensified conflict or insecurity in South Sudan, Yemen, the DRC, and northern Nigeria. In southern and eastern Africa, persistent drought is responsible for high levels of food insecurity. Also today, the Norwegian Refugee Council called South Sudan's food crisis shocking. The group says the threat of famine is more widespread and that tens of thousands of families are at risk of starvation. An estimated 6.3 million people, or half the population, currently face worsening food security levels. In Nigeria, the northeast state of Borno says it has shut down boarding schools indefinitely except in the capital and the town of Biu. Officials say they are taking urgent and immediate measures to improve security for students. The move follows last month's raid by the terrorist group on a girls' science technical college in Dapchi in the neighboring state of Yobe. Over 100 students were taken this week. The militants released scores of them while some still remain missing. Other girls hid from attackers and survived the attack. The raid came nearly 4 years after a similar mass kidnapping of schoolgirls in the town of Chibok. Reporter Isaac Linus recently visited Dapchi to speak to the survivors and to victims' families. VOA's William Eagle asked him what the girls who had escaped attack told him about the experience.
So by the time they got to the main road, outside the gate, they saw these people dressed in military fatigue. And they told them, okay, we are soldiers, please come in, come enter these vehicles. We're here to save you. And just as the girls were entering, so this very girl that I spoke with, she was with the hostel security man. So the hostel security man said he quickly dictated that they weren't putting on boots. So he told the girls that the ones that were close to him that they should not jump into that vehicle. But unfortunately, some of them kept on entering the vehicle. So the ones that were close to him, so he pushed them aside and that's how they ran, jumped over the fence, the school fence, and ran into the forest. That was how they escaped. And they slept in the forest and came back to the school the next day in the morning.
How are these girls doing today?
None of the girls was injured per se. We are talking about the ones that have escaped. None of them was injured. But of course, they are still in shock. Basically, they are still in trauma. They are still thinking about their friends. They are still thinking about some of their had siblings that got missing.
Did you also speak with the parents?
Yes, the parents are not happy. On the day that the girls were missing, a day later that the governor's spokesman announced on the radio that the girls have been found and that he was coming to reunite them back with these girls. And that was 3 days later. So by the time the whole town was in jubilation that the girls have been found. So by the time he came, when he got to the village, unfortunately, he told them that the girls were not found, that he thinks that the girls are not with Boko Haram. As every trace on the route that the Boko Haram passed through, that they followed the road and they didn't find the girls with the Boko Haram. So his thinking was that the girls most probably had fled into the bush, the forest. So when he said that there are a lot of women that just fell down unconsciously and they had to be taken to the hospital. You know, this girl's mother that I spoke to, that it was after like 5 or 7 days that I spoke to her, you could still see that she was still in trauma. You know, I met her, she was praying using her beads, this Islamic beads she was praying. And according to her, basically, what they are depending on is God, that God should come out and help them, comfort and help them.
Is it true that there was no security at the school?
Yes, it's true that there was no security. First of all, the army had released a statement because the governor said it was because the military people were pulled out. That was why they attacked. After the military people were pulled out, then Boko Haram went in to do this attack. So he blamed it on the military. The military also put out a statement, that was last week, to say that they had secured the town. And after securing the town, that they had handed over the town, since they felt that there was peace, they felt that there was no threat, security threat to Dutchy, so they handed over to the police. The police also immediately put out a statement denying that the military never handed over Chibok to them, never handed over Dutchy to them. You know, so it's basically a blame game.
Is there security now in the village?
Yes, there are two checkpoints, two military checkpoints just right in front of the gate of the school right now. And also there is a checkpoint, a military checkpoint, just before Chibok, where the police used to be. Security has been redeployed back to Dutch.
How is this issue now affecting politics or even perhaps the popularity of the Buhari government?
Before this attack, you know, people have agreed, even when the president and his military chiefs have said that they've technically defeated Boko Haram. But with this attack now, with this abduction, it has taken away everything that this administration has done in terms of security-wise. People are feeling very angry. A lot of people are feeling that Buhari has not done anything. And, of course, the opposition party, being the PDP, the People's Democratic Party, were just toppled in the 2015 election. Of course, they are saying that he does not have the capacity. It's clear that he does not have the capacity to rule this country, because as a military man, this is supposed to be one of his primary strengths. So it's really going to be something that is going to be a factor that he has to really deal with in 2019. I think it's going to work against him.
That was Nigerian reporter Isaac Linus. He was speaking to VOA's William Ego. The Pew Research Center released a report today on migration trends from sub-Saharan Africa to the United States and Europe between 2010 and 2017. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Philip Connor, a senior researcher at the Washington-based nonpartisan think tank, about the data revealed in the study.
And what we found is that there's been a rising number of people coming from sub-Saharan Africa to these destinations, and this has increased almost every year. We also asked some survey questions of sub-Saharan Africans to get a sense of what they're thinking about migration.
What did you learn there?
What we found is that majorities or near majorities in several sub-Saharan African countries would move if they had the opportunity and resources to do so. We also asked them if they were planning on moving in the next 5 years, intending to migrate. And in several countries, we found that large shares were also intending to migrate in the next 5 years to many places.
We knew before, of course, that people wanted to migrate and that they have been migrating. What did you learn that was kind of new or surprising to you as a researcher?
What was striking in the data as we were looking at it is actually the destinations that many sub-Saharan Africans were intending to move to in the next 5 years. The United States was often listed as the preferred destination, followed by Europe. And this is what led us to actually go into the data more further on the demographic side of things with the flows of migrants from sub-Saharan Africa to Europe and the United States.
Do you know why they prefer the United States over Europe? And is this a change from before?
Well, we don't have any trend data to be able to compare from before. But what we can look at is about people's personal ties, their relationships with family and friends through the phone and the internet. And those that regularly have contact with family or friends abroad, in the United States, for example, are also the same people that tend to plan on migrating to the United States within the next 5 years. The same is true of those that have personal ties within Europe. Those people also are more likely to make plans to migrate to Europe in the next few years.
Is this the so-called chain migration that President Trump is always talking about?
Well, we do know that we have seen a rise in the number of migrants from sub-Saharan Africa coming each year into the United States. Some of those are coming by family visas. When we look at Europe itself, the flows that we rely mostly on in this report of migrants are those that come as asylum seekers.
What are the numbers?
In 2014, there were about 140,000 asylum applicants from sub-Saharan Africa within European Union countries, Norway and Switzerland. That rose to about nearly 200,000 by 2016, and went down to about 170,000 in 2017.
We know that asylum seekers are escaping persecution for various reasons, but what about why people wish to migrate overall?
We know that economics is an important piece of that puzzle, as is for migration around the world. We also know that population in Sub-Saharan Africa is growing rapidly, and history will tell us that in places where there's growing populations, there's often an out-migration that also occurs. And we do see that the United States is this more preferred destination, even over Europe, when even geographically it is further away.
That might be surprising to some people because American policy has taken a somewhat harder line in the new administration.
Well, we don't speak to policy issues with the Pew Research Center, so I can't really comment on that. But we do know time will tell as to how that may play out.
That was Adam Phillips speaking to Philip O'Connor. You were listening to Africa News Tonight, live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. Past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Ethiopia is appealing for $1.6 billion in emergency aid for millions of people affected by drought, floods, and conflict. A new report says 124 million people in 51 countries last year faced acute hunger. South Sudan, Somalia, Yemen, and northeastern Nigeria were the hardest hit areas. And Somalian officials say a car bomb has killed at least 14 people in the busiest street in the capital, Mogadishu. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. The people of Cape Town are hoping for good rains during their approaching winter as the city endures one of the most devastating droughts in South Africa's recorded history. Day zero, so named by city officials as the day on which they could be forced to cut off the water supply to most homes, is set for July 15th, but is dependent on the levels of Cape Town's dwindling reservoirs. The City Council is urging each resident to use no more than 50 liters a day in a desperate attempt to avoid a catastrophe. Darren Taylor reports.
Senior city official Jean-Pierre Smith says the day zero scenario will be like organizing 100 soccer World Cups. He says it'll happen if Cape Town's 6 supply dams fall to a collective average of 13.5% capacity. They're currently at just 20%. On day zero, most of the city's taps will be turned off. However, water will continue to flow to places where vulnerable people are, such as hospitals, and to key economic nodes like airports and industrial zones. Smith, a member of the mayor's safety and security team, is one of the people responsible for Cape Town's disaster plan.
Even if the whole thing runs with military precision, it is still going to be enormously disruptive and have a major impact on our economy and civil society. So the goal here must be to avoid day zero.
But if it cannot be averted, residents will have to queue for their daily ration of 25 litres at more than 200 points across the metro region.
The mechanism is sort of self-regulating in that there's only so much water you can carry away and that every time you do, you need to queue again.
In a city of about 4 million people, Smith says officials will need to provide water to hundreds of thousands of people at the collection points all day, every day.
In one particular area where you need to get maybe 5 to 10,000 people through, if the entirety of the people in that area arrive after work, for instance, we're trying to see exactly how long the modelling takes to get the last one through the point.
Smith describes the logistics involved in implementing the plan as amazingly complex. The municipality says citizens will be responsible for their own water collecting vessels. But what will happen, for instance, if many arrive at the points with small containers and the queues slow?
it may lead to very significant levels of frustration or aggravation among people. And of course, that's why one has to have significant resources available. The South African National Defence Force and the National Police Service, as well as the city's traffic law enforcement and Metro Police, will be at these spots.
Smith says each water point will be staffed by up to 100 officials, supplemented by thousands of volunteers. But areas of Cape Town are plagued by gang violence, murder, and rape. So Smith's department has categorized the proposed water distribution sectors as high, medium, and low risk.
We've been guided by the crime stats in various areas. We know where the high risk areas are, and we also know where we are dealing with significant amounts of public disorder or public violence. And at those places, we increase the security presence.
Smith remains encouraged by Cape Town's response to its water shortage. From big business to individual households, he says, people aren't wasting water like they used to. For example, they're using shower water to wash dishes. Some factories have drilled their own boreholes.
So we've seen our water consumption coming down from over 1 billion liters a day to just over 500 milliliters a day now. On the plus side, the crisis has allowed us all to rapidly embrace water savings that we should all have been doing for the last 5 years. Many households around the city has massively reduced their consumption and learned that they can actually live with this quite comfortably. We were all maybe a little bit less frugal with water than we should have been.
So how confident is Smith that day zero won't happen? He says if Capetonians ramp up their water saving even further, and if reasonable rains fall within the next few months, they'll escape it. But he doesn't want to be too optimistic.
As soon as you tell people that the pressure is off, the consumption might spike again, and then we are in trouble. And secondly, it's dependent on winter rains coming in June and July. We've had 3 years of atrocious rainfall figures. The climatologists tell us that we're unlikely to have yet another year of such rainfall, but we cannot guarantee that. It might happen.
If it does, Cape Town will become the first city in the world to effectively run out of water and offer arguably the most potent evidence yet of the dangers of climate change. I'm Darren Taylor for VOA News in Johannesburg.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Wojtek Zordiak, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Impoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. This is James Barty, host of Daybreak Africa, inviting you to join me every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC as we bring you the latest in African news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our listener mail segment by sending your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. You can also call us and leave us a voicemail at 202-205-9942. That's 202-205-9942. And when you hear the Voice of America identification, press the number 25 to leave us your message. Start your day with Daybreak Africa every weekday morning at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC on the Voice of America.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.